How many shadows can fall on one man? Welcome to Uncle Bob's Campfire. Lights out, Bob.
I appreciate you going camping with me, even if I'm not the most popular person in the family. You surprised me on the hike today when you asked if I would tell you my stories, the ones that have gutted so many of my relationships. Just remember that things being unbelievable doesn't make them untrue. I had forgotten how sudden darkness can be in this forest. Do you know what absolute darkness is? It's a new moon tonight, and clouds hide the stars. If we were to put out this fire to the last ember and turn off the lantern, we would still not reach absolute darkness. The absence of light is the first step, yes, but night in its purity does not exist on the outside only. It burrows inside you, and when you walk through it, you get the sensation you're moving through concrete, and the dread, the menace creeping towards you from what direction, you can't tell. That's how you know you're in absolute darkness. When I was about 13, I reached a point where I couldn't take it anymore. I left my home, my school, my life, everything. I don't want to get into details now, but my mind felt like a crumbling wall. We hadn't been living in Doradoville long, but I needed to leave town before the wall disintegrated entirely. I knew the bad dreams would just stop if I left. One day, after what would be my last time at the school I wanted to forget, I simply stuffed my backpack with an extra change of clothes, a canteen, rope, a pocket knife, a week's worth of granola bars, a flashlight, and what little cash I had. I slipped on my hand-me-down dark gray hoodie, and then, with my dad at work, my mom changing the baby, and my other siblings watching Tiny Toon Adventures, I simply walked out the door. My destination was a wide bridge that cars used to go back and forth into town. Below it, the river had risen above its normal level due to the rains that year, but there was still a little patch of earth where I could sleep, and more importantly, work. I spent my first afternoon on the lam searching the riverbanks for loose pieces of wood. When I returned with a heavy bundle, I found a man with a ratty sleeping bag under his arm standing near my backpack. I recognized him. I had found Waldo. Okay, I'm embarrassed to admit that I never learned Waldo's real name. The kids at my school called him that because he wandered the streets of town all day, and you would never know when or where you would see him. To them, he wasn't a person but a game. Who could find Waldo first? I don't know if I was the first kid to see him that day, but I sure was the first one to ever get that close. The eyes behind the gray beard studied me as intently as I studied him. He set down his sleeping bag and put his hands into the pockets of a long green coat that probably hadn't been washed since the Vietnam War. He stepped aside for me to pass and dump my load of planks. I tried to ignore him as I separated the wood. The smaller pieces, and the ones that were too rotten to be of any use, went into the burn pile. Unfortunately, I had forgotten matches. Waldo had a little box he stored in a protective Ziploc bag in his coat pocket, and he let me borrow a match in exchange for two granola bars. Before long, I had a fire as lively as this one going. Waldo helped himself to the best seat by the fire. He didn't talk much, but we came to an agreement that I was welcome to share his bridge as long as I didn't bring any trouble. I assured him I wouldn't be there long. The next morning, I ignored how stiff I felt from sleeping on the ground. I smothered the screaming of my dreams in the back of my mind. I got to work on the good pieces of wood. I tried tying some of them together with my rope, but I've never been great at knots. Waldo grunted something, shoved me aside, and lashed the boards together in a couple minutes. I took off my shoes and waded into the river with my new creation. It didn't sink. It would do nicely. Waldo asked me what I was planning on doing with that raft. I replied by asking him if he had read Huckleberry Finn. He had. "Then you know what I'm doing," I said. "No parents, no teachers, no bullies, no nightmares. Just me and the river. Who knows where I'll end up, but I'm sure it'll be better than here." Waldo nodded. He leaned back against one of the pillars of the bridge and chewed on a cigarette. He watched me play with the raft for a few minutes, then asked, "How are you planning on getting past the dam?" Since I was new to town, I had no idea a concrete structure known as Raleigh Dam was 5 miles downstream, and past that, Waldo said, was a series of smaller dams for the next 50 miles. My raft and I didn't stand a chance. Waldo helped me burn it, though he took my rope for his troubles. I had no choice but to get out of town by land. Mountains and farmers' fields surrounded Doradoville. Baker's Point was the closest beacon of civilization, but that city was 30 miles away by a busy highway. Unless I wanted to climb countless fences, scale a couple mountains, and trudge through muddy fields, I had to get a ride. I wish I had known about the dumb dams before I wasted precious time building the raft. I'd been gone 24 hours, but that was enough time for posters of my face to be plastered everywhere in the bus station. Buying a ticket would essentially be turning myself in. I ran out of there before I was seen. I returned to the bridge in defeat. Waldo was waiting. I told him my situation. He shrugged and told me to take the tour. At the other end of town was the Chamber of Commerce, which operated a converted school bus that gave guided tours of Doradoville and the surrounding area. The bus took tourists within a quarter mile of Baker's Point. It took nearly all my money to buy that ticket. I got on the bus just before it left the city's visitor center. This late in the day, there weren't a lot of us. In the front sat a businessman in a cheap plaid suit. Toward the middle was a young mother with a baby boy in a car seat next to her. I took a seat in the back near three Cub Scouts on a sugar high and their long-suffering adult leader. No one paid attention to me. Everyone was just grateful to get out of the sudden rainstorm. As soon as we pulled out, the overly enthusiastic bus driver grabbed the mic on the dash and began a spiel on how Doradoville was the wonder of the West. I learned more about that town than I ever wanted. How it started as a mining community in the mid-1800s. How the schools were built by a group of ladies who had a reputation for being witches. Why the mansion that looked like a castle on the northeast of town was abandoned. Who designed the soccer fields and why they never thought to build adequate drainage so they wouldn't flood as they were doing now. And on and on and on. When we crossed Waldo's Bridge, I noticed the river was rising rapidly. The driver couldn't contain his excitement about how we were going to go to the overlook of the Devil's Bowl, despite the fact that the rain wouldn't let us see half a mile ahead of us. We took a turnoff onto a gravel road, and the driver launched into more history. The miners weren't that successful, he said. They spent years drilling into the walls of the Devil's Bowl in their search for gold, and they had nothing to show for it. But that was fine, since they had accidentally built two fine towns. The businessman asked the driver why the miners were so convinced there was gold in the Devil's Bowl. The driver shrugged and said they were going off some Native American legend, which was funny, since the same stories that promised gold in the Devil's Bowl also said there was a great evil too, but the miners, in their greed, only paid attention to the first part. At this point, the Cub Scouts behind me started to pay attention. Our guide could only give them one more detail. Whatever things lived in the dark liked to play with their food. He didn't have more to offer them, and the kids went back to their game of truth or dare. The rain was hissing against the windshield, and we could see nothing of the Devil's Bowl but a sinking fog below. It really is a beautiful view most of the time, the driver said. All striped with brown and gray stone. It's like the Grand Canyon's slightly less attractive little brother. The mother, who was leaning over the car seat as she bottle-fed her baby, asked if this meant we were going back to town. She could have asked if Christmas was going to be canceled. Are you kidding? The driver said. The bottom of the bowl is the best part on this here historical tour. You'll even see where the miners blasted the mines shut. The driver turned out of the overlook onto a steep, narrow road that descended into the bowl. We splashed through several large puddles at the bottom, and the rain stopped. The fog cleared a little, and clouds gave way to sun. The road looped around the perimeter of the bowl. The driver pointed out piles of gray boulders leaning against the rock. One of the Cub Scouts made farting noises. Why did they stop mining? The businessman asked. Run out of money, I take it. The driver said no one knew. One day, they simply called the venture done and sealed the mine entrances, even left some equipment inside. I bet it was money, the businessman said. The bus radio screeched an emergency alert alarm. Danger! Raleigh Dam has burst! Get to high ground immediately! Danger! The driver spun the bus around, stepped on the gas, and announced the tour was over. We heard the wave before we saw it. It was a roar I could feel in the soles of my feet. A long shadow hid the sun. The passengers shouted and cried. The bus didn't have seat belts, so I strapped my backpack to my front.
The pack was full of clothes, and I figured it was the next best thing to wearing a pillow on my chest. The water from the dam was a speeding tower of mud. It slammed into the side of the bus, and we went spinning. We came to a stop.
All of us were panting. Honestly, I think the baby was the only one who didn't need a diaper.
Our driver managed to laugh. Everyone okay? This wasn't on the tour, but we certainly won't charge you extra. The businessman pointed. The first wave had been a preliminary ripple. Now a brown, pulsing mountain was collapsing into the Devil's Bowl. I could feel the low hum of its movement in my teeth. Our driver revved the engine and shouted at the bus to give him everything it had, but it was too late. The bus flipped. I hit the ceiling or floor.
The current pushed us, submerged us.
Rocks squealed against metal and glass, and all light disappeared. I plummeted through the aisle and bounced off the windshield.
Everything went quiet. I awoke under a heavy weight.
Something was dripping onto my face. I was under something large, clammy, and lifeless. The driver. I shoved him off me and wiped his blood out of my eyes. I was pretty sure it was his blood. I wouldn't have known if I was blind. The darkness was so deep. A cold draft was on my right. I reached out and felt the bus door. It was hanging by its hinges and leaning inside.
I stood. I was sore and bruised, but had no broken bones. I moved toward the doorway, but I stumbled over what felt like a lump of rough fabric. I caught myself on the railing, and the thing bounced down the steps and through what remained of the door.
10 seconds later, I heard a distant thud. I realized that had been my backpack,
which also happened to contain my flashlight,
but it could have been me. The good news was that the bus was upright, but the bad news, one of the pieces of bad news, I mean, was that the bus was dangling over some sort of chasm. I backed away from the door. The mine, I said to no one. I fought a paralyzing panic. How deep had the wave pushed the bus? I fumbled with the bus radio and headlights. Both were as dead as the driver. It was just me, the silence, and the dark. My thoughts had been reduced to an animalistic sense of survival, and all I could do was walk. I kicked something that squirmed and groaned faintly in response. The businessman. I didn't stop. Not until farther down the aisle when a hand grabbed my ankle. A woman's voice said, "Help!" Her urgency snapped my mind into something a little more human. "My baby! Help him!" Her grip loosened, and she was still. Something was stirring nearby. I knelt and felt a bundle of blankets under the seat. Strong little hands gripped my finger. "Hey, little guy," I said. I felt around the floor a little more with my other hand and somehow found the kid's bottle. I shook it. It was mostly full. I slipped the bottle in my pants pocket and took the baby in my arms. He was calmer than I was. I kept moving until I reached the back of the bus. I asked if anyone was still alive, but no one answered, and I really didn't want to check if the Cub Scouts were dead. What could I have done for them anyhow? No, I had to get out and get help. I set the baby down in a seat. I found a lever and popped the back window open. I took off my shoe and dropped it out the back. It splashed without hesitation. I grabbed the baby and said a little prayer to, well, I don't know to whom. I felt far removed from any gods or celebrities I knew of. I jumped into waist-deep water. I didn't lose my hold on the child pressed against my chest, despite the shock of how cold the water was. Once I found my shoe, I was off to where?
I figured the best way was to get far from the chasm, that is, proceed straight from the rear of the bus.
The pool didn't extend very far, and I clambered onto land.
The wet rock and little puddles in the depressions in the floor were a good indicator I was headed against where the current had been.
My steps were deliberate and slow. The ground was slippery, and I didn't know if I was 1 footfall away from going off a cliff. I wasn't sure if I was in a tunnel or a cavern. In fact, I got the impression I was walking and sliding through empty space.
I almost believed I was an eyeless creature of the eternal underground, and light was the stuff of an imaginary universe.
The only thing that kept me from breaking out into a crazed run that probably would have ended with my neck being broken was the baby I held. I didn't know his name, so I named him Huckleberry because why not? My baby sister would have been screaming her head off at this point, but not Huck. I stroked the back of his bald head, and he cooed at me. It was a simple sound, but it made me smile. I recalled my dad telling me once that even the best babies were time bombs. One that's content 1 minute can be shattering your eardrums the next. All the more reason to get out of here, and I would wait till Huck got fussy to give him his bottle.
Unfortunately,
the passage appeared to have ended at a wall. It looked as if I'd have to find another way. That's when I became aware of a noise. It wasn't my breathing or Huck's, and it wasn't dripping water. It was shuffling and nibbling, like what you hear when rodents have infested the walls of a house. Just bats, I told Huck. The sounds were far above me. Or were they below? Wherever they were coming from, they were getting closer. Hey, Huck. You seem scared, I said. Huck just nuzzled against my shoulder. The shuffling was now countless scratchings on rock. I wanted to sing Huck a lullaby, but let's not kid ourselves. I wanted to sing myself a lullaby. I couldn't hold the notes. All that came out was, what shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? I pressed my palm against the rock and wished I could somehow sink through it. The nibbling now sounded like thousands of teeth grinding. Tears stung my cheeks. After all I had been through in my short life, this was how it ended. Eaten alive in the dark, clutching a baby. I pressed my back against the wall, and my heel struck air. A tunnel. I got to my knees and wormed through a narrow upward passage. A fine dust rained on us. I coughed and covered Huck's little face with the blanket for protection.
The tunnel was dry, so I was no longer following the water that had brought us here.
I kept going. The tunnel widened so I could stand, and I couldn't hear the creatures anymore. My knees were burning from the crawl, and my arms were getting sore from holding Huck. My adrenaline was disappearing, and I so wanted to fall asleep in the darkness. I knew I had to keep going, but my legs were getting heavy. Huck started to cry. 1 minute's rest wouldn't hurt, right?
I tried to rock the baby, but he was having none of it. I remembered the bottle in my pocket. I figured the kid must be hungry, but it seemed he drank it in 2 gulps. I was able to hold it together to sing a few more verses to Huck, including my 2 favorite.
Throw him in the longboat till he's sober, and shave his belly with a rusty razor.
We just sat there for a few minutes, with me going off about what happens to inebriated dudes on ships early in the morning.
Huck relaxed and clutched my finger in a strong grip. I kissed the top of his hairless head and told him it was time to go. The temperature suddenly dropped. I bundled Huck like a little burrito and only left him enough room to breathe. I don't know how long I went after that. Time, like light, was a fantasy. The ground was angling upward, and the air was getting fresher, though colder. My footsteps were squelches now, so I supposed I had gotten back on the path the bus had taken. The good feeling building up in me left, though, when I tripped and nearly dropped Huck. I dragged my hand along the wet dirt and found what had been in my way. A body. At first, I thought it was someone who had been thrown out of the bus. But when my fingers went from limp flesh to a curly beard to a long coat, I knew it wasn't anyone on that tour. I felt the inside of the coat and found the Ziploc bag behind some soggy cigarettes. Only 2 matches remained. I hesitated before lighting one. I wasn't afraid of wasting it. I had to see where I was. After the experience that had led me to run away in the first place, I never wanted to see a dead body again. But I knew I wouldn't resist looking at it. I lit the match, and I was relieved to find I wasn't blind. I could see the flame, as powerless as it seemed in the flickering shadows. I got the corpse gazing over with. Waldo wore a surprised expression on his unnaturally flabby face. Had he been under the bridge when the current swept him away? Had he been wandering near Raleigh Dam? It didn't matter, because in the end, I found Waldo in the dark. I had won the game, but it didn't feel like it. The flame had almost reached my fingers when I gazed around me. This part of the underground was wide, with a high ceiling, but it narrowed ahead. There wasn't much to see, and yet
I became aware of shapes on the far end of the chamber. They weren't part of the cave itself. They were human-like shapes,
Hundreds of them, like statues of small children. I took a step to the left, and the shapes simultaneously, silently, moved in the same direction. The match scorched my fingers and I dropped it. I was in absolute darkness again. I scooped up Huck and continued as quickly as I dared to go. How long had the things been following me? Why had they made noise before, and now, why were they quiet? The only answer I could come up with was what the bus driver had said. The demons in the mine like to play with their food. Huck sensed my worry and wiggled in my arms. Since I had lost the empty bottle somewhere back there and I didn't have a pacifier for him, I let him suck on my index finger for a little while, which seemed to appease him. After several minutes or hours, I heard something behind me. Or was it ahead? It was a single, high-pitched giggle. Another joined, and another. The voices were excited and mocking. I tried to distance myself from the laughter. My elbows rubbed the walls on either side of a tunnel that was too straight to have been made by nature. And wood. This particular tunnel was reinforced with wooden beams. It abruptly widened, and I bumped into something. It was a long scrap of metal. A few steps more, and I ran into a large tire. Pieces of the bus. I saw a light. I blinked, but it wasn't a mirage. It was hardly anything. A pinprick at most. I took another step. I saw a few more lights. "Stars, Huck," I said. I didn't know if the baby could hear me over the growing laughter. We were in faint moonlight. I squinted at the final chamber. Some distance ahead was a ragged window to the night sky. To my right, I could make out the shadows of another passage, wider than the one I had come from and filled with more debris from the bus. Its final route.
And on the far wall was a ramp. It went up to a ledge I'd say was 6 feet off the ground.
On that ledge was... it was hard to make out, but it had wheels. The giggling stopped. A single voice remained. It was singing. "What shall we do with the drunken sailor?"
The voice was mine, but it wasn't coming from my throat.
"What shall we do with the drunken sailor?" I moved toward the exit. More of the creatures joined the song.
It was like hearing 100 tape recordings of myself.
"What shall we do with the drunken sailor?" Despite the fact that I could sort of see, I couldn't make out the singers. "Early in the morning." As I moved toward the exit, they continued with the other verses, in the same order I had sung them to Huck. "Put him in the longboat till he's sober. Shave his belly with a rusty razor. Give him the hair of the dog that bit him. Soak him in oil till he sprouts a flipper. Have you seen the captain's daughter?" I clutched Huck. I had read somewhere that lions will automatically run after you if you run. After centuries of chasing antelope, they can't help it. I didn't know if these things had the same sort of instincts, but I didn't want to find out. I walked, but not too fast. I was almost there, and there was no way I was going to be the antelope.
A human-like shape dropped from above, then more. What I had thought were shadows faded and fell from the ceiling.
Their little, pot-bellied forms were silhouetted against the sky, and they crept toward me. Beads of saliva dripped onto rock like a tiny rainstorm. I backed away from the exit. Just when I thought escape was possible, the creatures were ready to feast on my guts.
I guess that was the whole point of the rat sounds and giggling, to herd me like an animal to their slaughterhouse. Their idea of fine dining must have been devouring hope, then flesh. They liked to play with their food.
Now the creature sang a verse I had never sung. "Lick his bones till they have no flavor." Huck sobbed. I rubbed his back, but he was not comforted.
My leg brushed against something hard, but softer than the surrounding stone.
It was the ramp, an earthen structure that led to the wheeled thing on the ledge. I had nothing to lose, so I gave Huck what I was sure was a last kiss on his smooth head, and I leaped onto the ramp and scrambled to the ledge. The little vehicle was covered in what felt like a giant, oily cloth made of some sort of hide. Still holding Huck, I yanked the covering off. Both of us coughed in the ensuing dust cloud. I was hoping to find something to defend ourselves with. I don't know, some 19th century rifles or bayonets or something.
Instead, all I found was a dozen little barrels.
Looking for a mini gun shop in a cave was stupid anyway. Now, in my final moments, I had found a wagon bearing the miner's beer storage or something. But that rotten eggs and metallic smell, it was like fireworks. This was gunpowder. In the dimness, I now made out what appeared to be strings coming out of the barrels. I didn't dare put Huck down, so with one of my hands being at an odd angle, I got the Ziploc bag out of my pocket. I managed to open it, and I lit the last match on the second try. The fuse of one of the barrels ignited like a sparkler and made the half-darkness around me pulse and whirl. I used the lit fuse to light two more. That's all I could do before I heard the little feet pounding against the ramp. With one hand, I tossed the first container over the wagon onto the ramp, but far enough from me and the other barrels, I hoped. When it hit the ground, I closed my eyes at the little flash and bang. Wailing and moaning replaced the singing. I hefted the next barrel, but I dropped it on the ground just below the ledge when teeth sunk into my arm. I nearly dropped Huck. In the flickering light of the fuses, I looked down at him. In the blankets was a hairless creature with wide, cloudy eyes. Its fangs were in my skin, and it was moving its bulbous head back and forth like a hunting dog. I tried to shake Huck off, but its jaw had locked. I leaned over the wagon, just over the final lit fuse. Flames crept up the blanket. Huck screeched and released me. He slid out of the fire and disappeared into the mass of his buddies below, and the burning blanket fell onto the rest of the barrels. The second barrel exploded just as I jumped off the ledge. The creature scattered. I rolled onto the ground and ran. Then the rest of the barrels went up. The mine rattled with a boom and white light. Bits of rock fell into my hair and cut my neck. Nothing stopped me from reaching the exit, and I found myself hugging mud below a crescent moon. I didn't have time to catch my breath. On the other side of the Devil's Bowl were quickly approaching flashlights. I waded through the grime and wet earth to get away from the mine before the people with the flashlights could see me. They would ask me questions and send me back to town, and even though I longed to see human beings again, I refused to go home. I couldn't go home. That would mean the nightmares again. By the time they reached the mine, I was far enough away not to be seen, but close enough to hear them. They were a rescue team from the county, and they had been searching for the bus for hours. The bangs and lights had attracted their attention, and they were amazed to find the floodwaters had broken through the entrance. They exclaimed something about finding pieces of the bus, but nothing about finding the demons of the mine, living or dead. I sloshed my way out of the bowl, up the road and back onto the highway. No one saw me. The water hadn't reached this higher elevation, and I had an unencumbered short walk to Baker's Point, which I reached unnoticed thanks to the road closure. I read the story in the papers later. Once the rescuers discovered the mine was open, they found the bus in just a few minutes. Apparently, in the absolute darkness, I had taken the long way out. The rescuers told reporters it was a miracle that a wagon loaded with ancient, weak explosives spontaneously went off and caught their attention so they could reach the bus in time to give first aid to those on board. And although the bus driver didn't make it, everyone else was still breathing and had passed out from blood loss, shock, or head trauma. Almost everyone. The only person awake when the rescuers climbed through the already open rear hatch of the bus was a crying, curly-haired baby who had woken up in his car seat with his mother asleep beside him. It was probably a good thing that the people in the bus weren't awake. How could the creatures play when their food was unconscious? As far as I know, all the passengers lived. But in the official report, one of the passengers was presumed dead. It was the teenager whose backpack was found at the bottom of a shaft. His body was never found, though the police didn't have a hard time figuring out who the guy was after getting my description from the survivors. Look, I'm not proud of the fact that your grandparents thought I was dead for a time, and I did nothing to dispel that belief. And I don't know if Waldo's body was ever found. I should have told someone about that, too. When I reached Baker's Point, clouds covered the sky again, and a heavy rain fell. I paused under a street light and glanced down at my torn, blood-soaked hoodie. My arm wasn't bleeding anymore, though the bite marks still stung. I expected to see mud and dirt, but a glittering yellow was streaming off my skin and clothing. By the time I found shelter under an awning, it was too late. The last of a golden dust was flowing off my clothes, into the gutter, and swirling into a storm drain. And I was worthless again. But it didn't matter, because I felt free.
free from the mine, free from the terrors of my dreams in Geradoville, free from what lurked in my school, and free to start a new life. But I had only begun to fall into the abyss.
This episode was written and performed by Robert Patton. Uncle Bob's Campfire is a Curious Realms production.